Dragon Slayer dropped from the sky like a huge, sleek black bird. Under Grimaldi's sure touch, the chopper streaked in across Coyote Field's weed-strewn strip, then swept broadside on as she hugged the ground, coming to a controlled hover a few feet above the concrete apron. The side hatch hissed open, and Able Team went EVA, hitting the ground running, fanning out with their weapons online. The second the last man exited the chopper, Grimaldi hit the power and took the black aircraft into a rapid climb, bringing her nose around to cover the hangars and control tower.
On your left. Got him.
An armed figure had emerged from the control tower door. Lean, dark, and wielding a 9mm Uzi, the man opened fire as he spotted the black-clad Blancanales. His rapid burst was well short, chipping the concrete. Blancanales, equipped with an M16, pulled it to his shoulder, aimed, and triggered a quick burst at his target. They punched him in the center chest, knocking the guy off his feet. He hit the wall behind him and fell face down, his Uzi clattering across the concrete. There was a flurry of movement from the second hangar. Armed men opened fire on Able Team. The Stony Man trio had already spaced themselves well apart. They returned fire from three positions. Schwartz had an M203 grenade launcher attached to his M16. He had loaded it with a smoke canister, which he fired in through the hangar door. It landed with a soft thump, coils of thick smoke starting to issue from the canister when it detonated. Lyons had cut off to one side, coming in at the hangar from a sharp angle, firing his spaz shotgun as he neared the hangar opening. He caught one armed figure as the guy leaned out. The powerful charge took him in the left side of his torso, close to his shoulder, tearing out bloody flesh. The man went down on his knees, wildly clutching at his left arm as it hung by bloody tatters of flesh. Gunfire erupted from both hangars, clipping the concrete around Able Team as they moved in with relentless determination, laying down steady and accurate return fire.
We're pushing them back. Keep it up.
The hangar defenders retreated deeper inside the structures, where their ability to respond was reduced. One man tried to clear the main door of the hangar holding a semi-trailer, exposing himself so he could take aim. He was targeting Lyons, briefly ignoring the other Able commandos. Schwartz, his M16 snug against his shoulder, tracked the guy and fired. The M16 jacked out two close shots. They hit the would-be shooter over the heart. He took a faltering step back, then sank into a sitting position on the hangar floor, remaining upright for a few seconds before folding over at the waist.
Move in!
Blancanales hit the outside wall of the hangar, flattening against the metal. He edged along the wall until he reached the open doorway. From his position, he could see the semi-trailer's rear. He could also hear movement from the shadowed interior, the scrape of footsteps. He held his position for a few seconds.
Going in.
Without further delay, Blancanales ducked low and went inside, moving instantly to his left, eyes searching the comparative gloom of the hangar. He could still hear movement deeper inside the structure. Blancanales dropped to a crouch and closed in on the semi-trailer's rear. He lowered his head and flattened out, sliding in beneath the vehicle, checking out the back section of the hangar. He saw legs and feet, counted three people. Blancanales took the farthest target first. He brought his M16 into target acquisition and triggered fast shots that ripped through the hard man's lower limbs, dropping the guy to the floor. As the gunner's weapon clattered to the floor, Blancanales hit him with a single shot to the head, laying the guy out flat. Swiveling, Blancanales tracked a second guy as the man began to move. He caught his target on the run, putting 5.56mm slugs in through his ankles, splintering bones and removing the man's ability to remain upright. As the man collapsed on his knees, the Able Team commando put three shots into his lower torso, one of the slugs blowing out the far side of the man's body. He fell sideways, his skull cracking against the concrete as he sprawled on the floor. The third man took off for the rear of the hangar. Blancanales rolled out from beneath the semi-trailer and pushed to his feet, scanning the interior, and spotted the guy heading for the far end of the building and a possible exit. The rear section of the hangar held a lot of equipment that had been pushed there to keep it out of the way. Blancanales' quarry missed his way and found himself blocked off from the building's far wall. He paused, looking for a way through, then realized he was losing ground. He turned, brought up the SMG he carried, and laid a burst in the direction of the man following him. Blancanales heard the slugs hit the concrete, lifting thin flakes from the surface.
Give it up!
Never!
The guy bounced off and fell face down, his blood spattering the oily floor. There was a rattle of sound behind Blancanales. He spun and spotted a moving figure in the cab of the semi-trailer. The man was pulling an assault rifle into position, freeing the driver's door at the same time. The Able Team commando raised the M16 and jacked off another burst that blew out the windshield and went on to punch into the gunner's chest and throat. Blancanales scanned the hangar. There was no more sound or movement. He headed back toward the semi-trailer. Reaching the rear, he yanked the locking lever and released the doors, swinging them wide open. As light flooded the interior, Blancanales saw the orange-yellow 30-foot outline of the Moab, resting on a metal trestle.
Bomb located.
Schwartz heard Blancanalis' words as he returned gunfire coming from the hangar into which he had lobbed the smoke grenade. The thick smoke was still rolling out the door. No one else had come out of the hangar, which concerned Schwartz to a degree. He was sure there were more of the opposition in there, but their no-show had him puzzled.
Hey, Paul, is there a back door in these hangars?
Yeah.
Great.
You want backup?
I'll handle it. You keep your eye on that bomb.
Watch yourself.
And you.
Schwartz moved to the wide doorway and peered inside. The thick, curling smoke obscured his vision. He saw that the density was less on the far side of the hangar, so he slipped inside and angled across. The building contained two panel trucks and a dusty Ford 4x4. As Schwartz emerged from the smoke, he saw two armed figures making for the parked vehicles. One man wrenched open the driver's door of the Ford while the other turned, attracted by Schwartz's footsteps. Schwartz raised his M16.
It's not gonna happen. Put the guns down and get on the floor. Do it now so I don't have to shoot you.
Why should I listen to you?
We have the bomb now. You don't get to use it.
No, you are lying, as all you Americans lie.
Don't start with the propaganda speeches. I'm not in the mood. Put down the guns.
The man who had been opening the Ford's door became agitated. He began to punch the air with his fist. He stepped away from the 4x4.
We are the chosen. We will never surrender.
Look, I told you.
The man suddenly brought his SMG up from where it hung by his side.
God damn you.
The impact kicked the guy backward, bouncing him off the side of the 4x4. He slithered to his knees, then toppled back, ending up half-sitting against the front wheel. The moment he pulled the trigger, Schwartz moved the muzzle of the M16 to cover the second guy. He had turned to look at his fallen partner, then swiveled at the hips, his own weapon angling up in Schwartz's direction. The trigger went back and the SMG stuttered loudly, shell casings jumping from the eject port to bounce as they hit the concrete floor. Schwartz felt something burn across his left hip, the force of the impact pulling him off balance. Even so, he held the M16 on target and returned fire, and saw his shots punch the other guy in the high shoulder. Dark flecks blew out from the guy's shirt. Schwartz hauled himself upright and gripped the rifle, taking a second to hold his aim before he fired again, ejecting 2-3 shots at the target. This time, his aim was online, and the 5.56mm slugs thumped home with deadly effect. One shot shredded the side of the man's throat, blood starting to pump out almost instantly. The guy fell against the Ford, hands splayed out across the front fender. Blood jetted across his hands, streaking the paintwork of the 4x4 as the guy lost his balance and hit the concrete. Schwartz clamped a hand over his aching hip. He could feel blood leaking out of the rip in his black suit, wetting his fingers.
Damn it, this isn't my week. Hey, Jack, you receiving me?
I'm here.
Could do with a bandage.
You got it, pal.
Carl Lyons kicked in the door to the control tower. He went up the worn wooden stairs two at a time, the SPAS shotgun tracking ahead of him. As he neared the top, he picked up the scrape of footsteps on the floor above him. His blood was up. Over the past few days, the intrigue and the twisted plans of Razan Kariza had pushed the Iron Man to the edge. He had seen enough death and destruction caused by the Fedayeen crew to last him a lifetime. Bucklow, Texas, a small community where the population most likely carried little or no hostility toward Iraq, where families only wanted the same as any family the world over, to live safely, to get on with their daily lives, and to watch their babies and children grow and play and laugh in the Texas sun. That right, that simple, God-given right, at the heart of every family in America, had been wrenched from their grasp in those terrible moments when the bomb had detonated at the Bucklow picnic ground. The hungry, grasping, life-devouring fire had denied them their birthright. Carl Lyons' eyes mirrored those dying moments as he reached the head of the stairs and turned to face the trio of Fedayeen loyalists, the barrel of the shotgun already online. His face was hardened by his thoughts, lips peeled back from his teeth in a snarl of utter contempt for the men who were willing and ready to bring down the same fate on yet another American community. The sound of a single pistol shot was drowned by the hard boom of the 12-gauge. Flame and smoke gushed from the muzzle as Lyons tripped the trigger and used the remaining shots in the magazine. He fired and traversed and fired again. His targets, their own attempts at defending themselves snatched from their hands by the relentless onslaught, were blown across the control room in a welter of blood, pulped flesh, splintered bone, and shredded clothing. Blood spattered the control tower windows, splashed the control board. When the SPAS locked on an empty chamber, Lyons stood stock still, silently observing his kill zone. One of the hitmen moved slightly where he had slumped across the control board. He was bloody and in shock, one hand flapping ineffectually. Lyons moved closer, easing his python from its holster. He put a single shot through the wounded man's head, then he turned and did the same with the other two downed terrorists. The radio on the control desk crackled into life.
Come in, Coyote Field.
Lyons crossed to the control desk and leaned over it. He picked up the hand mic and pressed the transmit button.
Who the hell is this?
Am I speaking to Coyote Field?
Damn right, you prick. And I'm guessing you were expecting your Fedayeen brothers, am I right?
Who are you?
I'm the American son of a bitch who just blew your buddies all to hell.
Lyons picked up the approach of the heavy aircraft. He peered out the control tower window as the sound grew louder.
Permission to land denied. You won't be picking up your bomb load, sucker. Not today. Not ever. You came to my country and tried your shit. Well, not this time. You want pain? You want suffering? You can have it.
Lyons cut the connection and spoke into his throat mic.
You get that, Jack?
Affirmative.
Can you get a lock on that bastard?
Already have. He's starting to turn away. Looks like you scared him off.
Take him out, Jack. That fucker doesn't go home.
Dragon Slayer slid into view, then accelerated as Grimaldi boosted the power. The combat chopper climbed rapidly, tailing the dark bulk of the aircraft that had been making its approach to Coyote Field.
American! American, are you there?
You want to beg now?
I want to negotiate. We are unarmed.
Negotiate? Like you let all those people in Bucklow negotiate?
That was an act of war. And as this is war, we must be treated as prisoners. You will accept our surrender. We will land and you must take us prisoner and recognize our rights.
Jack, you get that?
I heard.
What do you say, Jack?
I say I got these suckers in my sights.
Finger on the button?
Just so.
Hit it.
Lyons watched as the heatseeker missile shot from the weapon pod under Dragon Slayer's stub wing and lanced across the sky, curving slightly as it picked up the source from its target.
Welcome to America. Fuck with us, we fuck you.
Negev Desert, Israel. Calvin James cleared the low, crumbling stone wall and dropped to a crouch, eyes scanning the immediate area. The first thing he saw was the large camouflage net extending out from the roofs of the low buildings, across the area where they had been secured on posts driven into the ground. The sandy enclosure concealed by the net held the accoutrements of a small group, kept neat and stored so that the camp could be quickly evacuated. He didn't have time for a much more thorough scan. On the far side of the enclosure, an armed guard turned, alerted even though James had made barely a sound. His hands swung the AK from his shoulder, eyes seeking the intruder. The Stony Man Commando was already ahead, his H&K online the moment he had touched down from his jump over the wall. James eased back on the trigger, firing a short burst that hit the guy in the chest, tumbling him back and off his feet. The guy landed hard as blood bubbled up his throat from a punctured lung. There was movement from inside the building, more from around the far side where Hawkins had made his entrance, and the camouflaged enclosure suddenly erupted with sounds of auto fire. For Ben Sharon, the next few minutes became the most important of his life as he battled to stay alive while defeating the invaders of his country. He had, like the others, breached the enclosure and found himself confronted by a startled man carrying an ammunition box. As they held each other's gaze for a heartbeat, it was Sharon who broke the frozen moment. The brutal blow split the guy's skin, blood welling up instantly and streaking his face. As the hard man stumbled back, dropping the ammo box and grabbing for the pistol on his hip, Sharon stepped in close. He drove one knee up into his adversary's testicles, then delivered another kick with the hard sole of his boot into the guy's left knee. Sharon didn't hold back as he heard the crunch of shattered bone as the leg gave and the guy fell, his leg unable to support his weight. Briefly in the clear, Sharon stepped back, brought his H&K around, and fired a burst that punched into his opponent's heart. Moving on, Sharon caught a glimpse of someone ahead of him, emerging from an opening door. The Israeli caught the gleam of a rifle barrel as it swung in his direction. He dropped to the ground, hearing the crackle of auto fire and the vicious snap of the slugs hitting the wall behind him. Gritty dust showered his back.
Shit!
Sharon rolled, twisting, and pulled his H&K from under his body. He saw the shooter turning to find him, then he was triggering the H&K, angling the muzzle up in the direction of the moving figure. The spray of shots climbed from the target's waist up to his chest. From his almost prone position, Sharon fired again, his second burst coring in under the guy's jaw, through his head, lodging just beneath his skull. Sharon was on his feet before the man hit the ground, heading directly for the door the guy had exited by. He ducked below the low top of the door and was confronted by a guy pushing up off a canvas seat in front of a communication system. The man was reaching for the assault rifle leaning against the comset table. Bringing the H&K on track, Sharon hit the guy with a burst that pushed him across the room and slammed him against the wall. The stricken man slid down the wall and lay curled up at its base. The sound of autofire was heavy in the air as T.J. Hawkins came face to face with his first adversary. The guy was big, stripped to the waist, his torso muscled and toned. He lunged at Hawkins as the Phoenix Force warrior stepped around the edge of a crumbled wall. Hawkins swung his H&K into play, but the terrorist was too close. The guy's big hand snatched at the SMG, using it to swing Hawkins off balance. He let go with one hand and used it to backfist the American across the side of the head. The blow dazed him and sent him reeling. The other guy moved in fast, his free hand swinging and clouting Hawkins across the face. Hawkins tasted blood as he dropped to the ground, still holding his SMG. The other guy clung to the other end of the weapon, refusing to give Hawkins any advantage. It meant he had to bend over to maintain his grip, and Hawkins launched a full leg kick, connecting with the guy's face. The terrorist's grip on Hawkins' H&K slackened, giving the American the slight advantage he needed. Hawkins yanked the H&K from the big man's grasp, rolled until he was clear, then came up on one knee. The muzzle of the MP5 targeted on the other guy, then spit out 9mm slugs that poured through the target's chest and destroyed his heart and lungs. The guy went down without a sound. Hawkins pushed upright, moving forward. As he rounded the corner of a wall, he saw James ahead of him. There was a body on the ground close by the Black Phoenix Commando. Movement caught Hawkins' eye, and he spotted two armed figures emerging from a doorway behind James. Hawkins ran forward, his H&K tracking the pair.
Cal, behind you!
James dropped to a crouch, twisting to face the newcomers. Hawkins targeted the hard man closer to his teammate, firing instantly, his shots punching in through the guy's side. Bloody slugs burst from the guy's body as he collapsed to the ground. James and the second terrorist fired together, their shots merging. Hawkins saw James jerk to one side, pain etched across his face. The guy the Black Commando had fired on stumbled, then went face down in the sand, body jerking in response to the sudden pain. Hawkins ran across to where James had sunk to his knees, hand pressed to his hip.
Cal, you hit?
Nah, thought I was.
He moved his hand, and Hawkins saw the shattered handle of the sheathed knife on James's belt. A bullet had struck it a glancing blow, driving the knife against James's hip.
You are one lucky dude.
Yeah, and only a bruise to show for it.
Hawkins turned, checking their surroundings. It had been the sudden silence that had unnerved him. He remained alert until Ben Chiron stepped into view.
I think we're clear. You okay, Cal?
James unsheathed his knife and held it up.
A bruise is all. Close, but no cigar.
Come and look at what they had in here.
Ben Chiron led them into the airless room and the communication system.
Small generator on the outside wall for juicing up the battery pack, and a radio for vocal communications. The laptop here is connected to a satellite uplink.
Chiron led them around the edge of the wall and indicated the dish antenna mounted on an extendable aluminum pole that could be raised up through the open roof and through the camouflage net.
Gives them plenty of range and access to satellite scanning. They can talk to anyone they want from here and use digital scanning to pinpoint ground images.
Back in the communication room, James bent over the laptop. There was an image on the screen that looked like a satellite terrain scan. He used the keyboard to access data input and was confronted by text in Arabic.
Anybody read this stuff?
Neither Chiron nor Hawkins could help. James perched himself on the canvas seat and began to access the computer system. He worked silently for a few minutes until he found the email facility and established contact with Stony Man.
He can do that?
Sure. He can do anything.
Once he had the email link established, James was able to send a message to Stony Man. He worked quickly, explaining what they had found and advising that he was going to transmit the data. He informed Stony Man that the documents would need to be translated and that the team might have to move on. Any intel would have to be sent to Chiron's Mossad contact in Tel Aviv. James sent the message. He waited until he received confirmation it had been received, then deleted all the current information.
Ben, why don't you call Davi in with the chopper?
Chiron nodded and moved outside to use his TACCOM unit. James and Hawkins searched the communication room. Apart from the radio and laptop, there was nothing else of value. The occupants had committed nothing to paper. Everything they had was on the laptop. James noted that it was a high-end Japanese machine. The radio equipment had been manufactured in the same country.
Somebody is probably making big bucks selling this equipment.
Always a market for this kind of stuff, Cal. Same as the arms dealing. If you have the money, you've got all you need.
Chiron reappeared. He had a bundle in his arms and threw it on the ground.
Our dead guys are a mix, Iraqi, possibly Algerian, no Palestinians. But look at this, all Palestinian-made clothing. The bastards even left the labels inside.
Little crude, isn't it? Doesn't exactly scream genuine, does it?
The climate in the region is fragile at best. If these were waved in front of TV cameras, people wouldn't ask why they were left behind. It would be enough to set off a few hotheads, maybe a few hundred hotheads. By the time they reached the streets and spread the news, there would have been bodies found wearing those same clothes. Brushfire tactics. You start a small fire, and before you know it, you have an inferno. And by then, it's too late to put out.
Maybe we can use this stuff to turn things around. Get your TV people to show what we found here. Show the communications set up, identify the bodies, convince the Israeli and Palestinian public this is a ploy by someone trying to mix things up between you both.
We don't have anything to lose. Tavi should be here in a few minutes. I got him to contact the military. They're going to send up an armed unit to take over this place and deal with anyone who might turn up.
What about the thought that maybe these guys were here to guide someone in? Namely, something in the air.
There will be air cover over this region within the hour. Radar scanning as well. Anyone who flies into this area will be tracked and challenged.
They might still try.
I hope they do.
The sound of Davi's chopper reached their ears. They would have to wait at the oasis until the military squad showed up. James uncoupled the computer and tucked it under his arm.
I'm bringing along this laptop. We might be able to pull more data from it.
Hawkins turned and followed Chiron. James trailed after them, his bruised hip starting to ache now. He took his time, but not just because of his hip. He had things on his mind.
You know, I'm thinking about the fact that Kariza was willing to launch an attack on a nuclear plant, despite the possible after effects across the region. If radioactivity was released, it could have drifted across the border into Egypt, across into Jordan or Saudi Arabia. I'm beginning to wonder if Razan Kariza is more than just a little irresponsible. I'm thinking more along the lines of maybe a lot crazy.
Over Korea Bay, Yellow Sea. McCarter leaned toward the window, peering out as the plane began to bank. They were over the Yellow Sea, and gray light was starting to show in the early morning sky. As the plane started to descend, he was able to see the ragged coastline of North Korea. Out in the bay were scattered islands, and McCarter realized they weren't aiming for the main landmass. Instead, the plane had leveled out, coming down faster now. They were going to land on one of the islands. Slumping back in the rigid seat, McCarter caught Enciso's eye. The Cuban leaned forward.
This could be interesting. That's one way of putting it.
Manning, sitting beside Enciso, opened his eyes. For the past hour, he had been sleeping, or at least feigning sleep.
You wanted to find out where they were getting their weapons. Looks like your wish will come true, Dorothy.
One of the armed Chinese stood and approached the Phoenix Force trio. He thrust his assault rifle in their direction. McCarter simply shrugged, holding up his cuffed hands.
What's got up your nose? What the hell am I gonna do? Take over the plane?
They do not trust you, even though you are secured.
McCarter glanced up and saw Kim Yo standing to one side.
Say, you lot aren't as dumb as you look.
You continue to bait me. Be careful. I may rise to your taunts and decide to kill you now.
McCarter refused to back down, staring directly at Yo until the Chinese looked away. He nodded to the guard, who returned to his seat.
Enjoy the rest of the flight. We'll be landing in a few minutes.
Hell, David, are you trying to get yourself shot? He hasn't brought us all his way to kill us now. You're 100% sure of that?
No.
I didn't think so.
They felt the bump as the plane touched down, then sped along an uneven runway. The brakes were applied and the aircraft began to slow. Glancing out his side window again, McCarter saw they were running parallel with the sea. The wing of the plane extended out over the edge of the island. Even though McCarter was able to see the choppy water of the bay, he could barely make out the North Korean coastline. The plane slowed, rocking slightly as wind buffeted it, then came to a full stop. The engines were cut, and as the noise faded, the sound of the wind could be heard. Yo approached them.
No sunblock needed here.
You will come now. Remember, you're on North Korean soil. They really do not like Westerners. I suggest you contain yourselves. Unlike we Chinese, these Koreans have little sense of humor.
Would you if you lived here?
Yo smiled briefly. Once outside and standing beside the plane, Phoenix Force and Henry Lee looked around. The outlook was bleak. The island, larger than they had realized, had little to recommend it. Rocky and flat, with barely any form of vegetation, it was open to the extremes of weather. The wind they had felt rocking the plane was stronger in the open. It buffeted them, tugging at their clothing and chafing their exposed skin. There were frequent sprays of seawater picked up by the wind as it swept across the island. The spray was chilled. Yo and his men ushered their captives across the open landing area. Some 300 yards away were rows of long, low buildings. As they got closer, they were able to see that the buildings were large, with wide roll-up doors. A number of open trucks were parked outside one of the buildings, and a lesser number of Jeep-type vehicles. McCarter glanced across at Manning and Enciso, who nodded slightly. The Briton turned to look in Lee's direction. The Chinese gave him a similar response. Yo directed them toward one of the buildings. One of the Chinese ran ahead and pushed open a small door set to one side of the main one. They all trooped inside, and the door was closed behind them. The interior of the building was lit from banks of fluorescent lights suspended from the roof beams. They threw cold illumination onto the floor of the building. Down the left side of the structure, a line of rooms, built from wood panels and glass partitions, ran half the length of the building. The main floor area was given over to storage. Here were lines of wooden packing cases of various shapes and sizes. A number of men in plain coveralls were busy with open packing cases, filling them from pallets being moved around on a forklift.
It's all very impressive, don't you think? The first time I saw it, I realized how efficient these North Koreans are.
Not so efficient at feeding their own people, are they? Too busy building missiles and statues to the great leader.
You could put that to our host. His reaction will be interesting to see.
Yo turned, indicating a slim figure dressed in a simple black tunic and pants. There was something in his manner, his thin face with its high, prominent cheekbones, that warned them he was a man of distinctly hostile moods. He moved quickly, hands at his sides, the hard-soled shoes he wore making sharp rapping sounds on the hard floor. A silent pair of black-clad men followed him closely. They carried auto pistols in holsters on their belts. Kim Yo turned to face the man, inclining his head as a form of greeting. The other made no response. Instead, he stopped to inspect the four captives. The man was Sun Yang Ho, the North Korean weapons negotiator, the man who was offering Razan Kariza his deal. He turned to Yo and spoke in English, it being the common language between himself and Yo. Neither could speak the other's native tongue.
Why have you brought these people here?
I am on my way to a rendezvous with Kariza after we complete our business. He will want to see them. And I thought it would interest them to see how efficiently your operation is run. After all, they have been interfering in Carissa's operation for some time. Now they can see how futile their efforts have been.
Keep them out of my way, Yo. They are American garbage. We have matters to discuss. There is no time to be wasted on these animals. And this Chinese man, why is he with them?
Their contact man. He belongs to one of those irritating freedom groups working against the government.
Then you should have killed him immediately, not wasted valuable time bringing him along. Yo, have you not learned anything? Alive, your enemies are dangerous. Dead, they can do no harm.
Yo considered the Korean's words. As he fell in beside Ho, he spoke quickly and quietly to one of his men. The Chinese turned around and raised his assault rifle. Enciso, watching the Chinese, realized what was going to happen.
Lee!
The Cuban pushed past Manning, but he was too late. Lee stumbled and fell to his knees, his face showing an expression of stunned horror. He started to fall over, pushing out his bound hands to stop himself. The Chinese triggered more shots, and they burst through Lee's upraised hands, taking off fingers before they struck him in the face. Lee hit the floor, his body shuddering.
You piece of shit!
Enciso would have gone for Yo if one of the Chinese guards hadn't stepped in front of him. He raised his rifle and slammed the butt across the side of Enciso's head. The solid blow dropped the Cuban to his knees, head down.
You see how they react. Too much emotion. They act before they understand the situation, and ultimately, they suffer for it.
Ho led Yo across the building, pushing open the door to one of the rooms. He indicated for Yo to sit across from him at the table dominating the room. There were computer terminals and telephones on the table. Ho used one of the keyboards and brought data onto the screen of the monitor in front of him.
Carissa's deposits have been transferred to our account. Shipments are already underway. Further shipments will now follow.
Ho tapped more keys, and on a side table on the other side of the room, a printer began to push out a continuous sheet. The Korean pushed to his feet and collected the printout, folded it, and handed it to Yo.
Please deliver this to the colonel when you see him. It is a list of the ordnance in the first shipment.
Yo took the printout. He placed it on the table, gently tapping it with the fingers of his right hand.
Am I detecting some impatience, Kimyo?
Much of Carissa's strategy revolves around the availability of the nuclear devices. He'll be asking about it when I meet him.
Of course. One moment. Purchase of the warheads from our Russian contact took time. Following the actual delivery, my technicians had to convert them from the original configuration to something capable of being carried easily. And there was the matter of the trigger devices.
Ho stood and crossed the room. A coffee maker stood on a wheeled trolley. Ho poured two cups and returned to the table, placing one in front of Yo.
Understand this, Yo. I am not offering excuses. It is not in my nature. I am merely explaining the longevity of this operation. It is not as simple as making this coffee.
I was not suggesting any deliberate lateness. It is more a need to placate Razan Kariza. Now that he has his operations underway, he is becoming increasingly anxious to carry it through.
Which I understand. Military strategy requires forward momentum. Too many delays and the advantage can be lost. You can inform the Colonel that his nuclear devices are now complete and are being loaded as we speak. They will leave within the next half hour. Delivering nuclear devices is not the same as sending out crates of rifles. Assure the Colonel that we are taking every precaution possible. He will get his bombs. He needs to remain patient a little longer.
I will pass along your message. And thank you, Ho, for being so direct. I understand the reasons for your caution.
Ho sipped his coffee. He placed his cup carefully on the table, nudging it with the tips of his fingers.
Tell me something, Kimyo, and this conversation will not go further than this room. What are your feelings about Colonel Kariza? Do you truly believe he is capable of carrying out his plans for Iraq?
I have had the same thoughts myself. When Kariza first contacted me, it took me a little time before I accepted he could do it. I believe he can.
His plan to use the nuclear devices. Has he given you any details on this?
That one he is keeping silent about. No matter how many times I have asked him, Kariza is not talking.
No matter. As long as he was willing to pay for those three bombs, I am happy to sit back and wait.
My commission for arranging the deal will satisfy my curiosity.
Let us have another cup of coffee. Then we will go and look at what Kariza's money has bought him.
War Room, Stony Man Farm, Virginia. Erica Dukas, seated across the table from Barbara Price, shuffled her papers. They were the first to arrive in the war room following Brignola's call.
I still keep seeing the look on Aaron's face when you stood up to him. It was worth the wait.
To be honest, I was ready to run at first. Then I figured, why not go for it? What could happen? He wasn't really going to eat me. Was he?
No. And you proved your point. There's something I wanted to say before, but never really got a proper chance. That was brilliant work you did on the translation, Erica. It gave us some important pointers.
Thanks. But like I said, it's what you got me here for. So I was just doing my job.
Some job.
The secure door opened and several people entered the room. Kurtzman led the way. Akira Takaido was close behind. Able Team was here in force. Herman Schwartz took his time as he crossed to the table. His face was badly bruised, the swelling increasing the effect. Dukas had heard about the beating he had received at the hands of Kariza's people during his captivity. This was the first time she had seen him since Able Team had returned from the field, and she was a little shocked at his appearance. If anything, it brought home to her the reality of the work these men did, the risks they undertook to keep the peace, as it were. Hal Brignola was the last to take his place at the table. He placed a file in front of him and opened it, then paused for a few seconds.
Still no contact with Phoenix. Two of Henry Lee's team found dead isn't a good sign, but it doesn't mean we write Phoenix off. No way that's going to happen.
What's the answer, Hal? Do we go in and look for them? Cal and TJ are still on assignment in Israel. No way we can pull them out.
We're working on something right now.
What about Mayanna? She knows the territory out there. Why not ask for her help?
Barb spoke to her some hours ago. Anna is on a USAF plane heading to us as we speak. They flew her out of Lackenheath. She'll land at Andrews. I'm going out to meet her once we wrap this up.
So let's move on for now. We need to cover other things. Aaron?
Kurtzman passed out thin files containing copies of data he had extracted from his computer searches.
This is everything we've been able to get from the stuff you people brought back. Cell phones, credit cards, anything we could check on. Telephone accounts, numbers called.
We hacked into anything with a name attached to it, like Radik Zalivik. On the surface, he's a clever guy who made his fortune buying and selling. Very smart. So smart, he started to get lazy. It could be he figured no one would connect him to what he was doing on behalf of Kariza, providing a lot of supposedly covert assistance soon after the Iraq War started. All in the background. Telephone calls are the quickest way to make contact. Trouble is, they leave traces, and Zalivik seems to have believed using the Cadeau's Nest account would hide everything from prying eyes. Once we made the connection between the business and Zalivik, it gave us a base to start from.
We have enough to connect Kariza to all the players in the game, the Gunrunners and Santa Lorca, in Mexico. We cross-checked calls back and forth. Luis Santos, Jafir Recife, Philo Vance. Read the lists. It all starts to come together. In brief, Kariza has one hell of a network running his operation. We've hit him where it hurts and done a great deal of damage to his plans. Cut off his South American arms supply, terminated a good number of those weapons caches throughout the country, and stopped the second MOAB from being used.
But not the first.
We can't always be in the right place at the right time. We don't win every round. David is still kicking himself because Kariza's people snatched those discs right from under his nose. Come on, people. We haven't come out of this too bad.
But there's still a way to go yet.
Let's hear what Erica has for us.
These sheets I'm passing out are the data Phoenix sent us from Israel, translated as a timetable for Kariza's forces in the Middle East. It's written in a way that encourages his followers to forego any kind of survival expectation. Their mission is all important: to destabilize the region and cause much confusion among the various countries. He calls on all loyal Islamics, regardless of where they're from, to rally to the cause. Kariza has three main objectives: major disruption within Israel, an ongoing guerrilla campaign within the U.S. and the U.K. He holds the U.K. as responsible as the U.S. for what happened in Iraq. His third objective is the restoration of Ba'athist Fedayeen control of Iraq. There is to be continued resistance within the country. All outside agencies, whether military or civilian, are to be targeted. In his words, the infidels who have defiled Iraq must be made to pay in blood.
How does he expect to achieve that? No way he's going to walk in and take over. And how does he expect to defeat the U.S. coalition force? If Hussein's entire military machine couldn't, how does Kariza figure to do it?
He simply says if his followers keep their faith, God will show the way. They have an abiding faith in what they believe, much stronger than Western ideologies.
Exactly. We're up against people who have been taught from birth that we are the enemy, that we're the most corrupt and evil people ever to walk on two legs. We can't be trusted. We're unholy, cruel, greedy. We have no values. And we use the excuse of democracy as a cloak to hide our misdeeds. They see what we do, what we say, and they don't forget the wrongdoings against them. A generation on, they don't forget. So they listen to their leaders and advisors, and they believe because, and don't doubt this, they take their religion far more seriously than we do. Just as Erica said, they see it as their mission to make us atone for what we do and what we have done.
You make it sound as if we don't have a chance of beating him in the long run.
Hell, if I believed that, I wouldn't be here. I'm just trying to say we need to view the threat by trying to understand it.
Hard to do when you're staring down the barrel of a gun.
I didn't mean try to convert them. More to understand what drives them. As FDR said, know your enemy and you have an advantage. We know Kariza is determined to get back into Iraq and some sort of control. We also have confirmation he's negotiating a deal with the North Koreans through Kim Yo. And he's intent on causing as much confusion as he can, both here in the U.S. and the Middle East.
My people will continue to monitor every angle. We're still sifting information, checking out all our sources in the Middle East. There's so much going on over there at the moment, we could choke ourselves on data. The main problem is sorting it into some kind of order. The minute we hook onto something useful, you'll have it.
10 minutes later, Brignola, Price, and Kurtzman were alone in the war room. At the conclusion of the meeting, Kurtzman had indicated he'd needed to talk with the pair of them.
I need to show you something. I set a search on something I spotted that had to do with the calls between Kariza and Zoltan Dushinov. They were intercepted on a computer belonging to the CIA. The odd thing is, they were picked up and isolated before they could be logged on the main CIA system.
Someone blocking input into the CIA? Someone running a covert program?
It's happened before. Aaron, can we get a fix on who it was? Already ahead of you. The computer had password protection and enough firewalls to hold back the Mississippi. It took a little time, but my program doesn't give up, and it eventually came up with a name.
Kurtzman hit the keyboard set in the surface of the conference table, and one of the wall-mounted monitors activated.
Remember that name Erica came up with? It didn't mean anything at the time. That's where I started. Rod McAdam, CIA. When my search broke the password on that computer, it identified it as McAdam's.
The screen showed the image of a middle-aged man, sandy hair and intense blue eyes. He was staring directly into the camera lens, almost defying it to show him as he really was.
My search brought up some interesting links. McAdam knows General Chase Gardner, U.S. Army. Gardner is a dedicated hawk. So much so, I'm surprised he doesn't have feathers. He doesn't go much for the government stance and thinks we're letting the country down. If he had his way, Gardner would most probably nuke the Middle East and North Korea based on gut instinct.
Gardner's image showed him as a lean, tanned man in his late 40s, a professional soldier through and through. His graying hair was short, his mouth held in a taut line.
Sleeps at attention, arms at his sides.
Do I detect traits of hostility?
Just an observation.
Kurtzman brought up a third image, an immaculately dressed and turned-out man whose silver hair was worn slightly long.
Senator Ralph Justin. He's one of Gardner's staunchest allies. When they're together, they demolish any argument like an advancing army. He's well-known in Washington. Like Gardner, Justin is independently wealthy. Treats the world as if he owns it. Probably does have a large percentage. Word is, Justin is an arrogant bully. And our CIA man, McAdam, knows Justin, too.
What detail do you have on McAdam?
He's a busy man. His CIA file has him running his own section, which the honchos at Langley use when they need something special done. He's worked a lot of covert ops for the agency over the years. He must have dirt on a lot of people in the service. His file has him as extremely ambitious and likely to take risks. He's considered to be crowding the edge. Could be why he hasn't advanced as quickly as he might.
So what's his connection to Gardner and Justin? And why show up in Rashid's notes?
That's the $64 million question, Barbara.
Gadgets and Grimaldi can go take a look at what these three are up to. Confirm or eliminate them from our current involvement. Set it up. I'm heading out to see Mayanna. I want Carl and Paul on standby to go with her to Hong Kong.
Andrews Air Force Base.
Is there anything I can get you?
Mayanna shook her head. She glanced around the interior of the Air Force Gulfstream C-20F. Brignola sank into one of the seats. It was comfortable, almost too comfortable.
No, thank you. They looked after me very well during the flight. You, on the other hand, look quite tired, Mr. Brignola.
It's been a busy time.
As I have been hearing.
Miss May.
Call me Anna, please.
Then call me Hal. Look, Anna, I wish I didn't have to ask for your help again so soon.
I owe you and your organization more than I can ever repay. Never feel you are asking too much.
When you spoke on the phone, you said there was something important you needed to discuss.
May brushed black hair back from her cheek. Her eyes were fixed on Brignola's face.
I found out why David and his team were caught by Kim Yo. They were betrayed by one of my own group. Someone who has abandoned us and informed Kim Yo. That is why Henry Lee and your team were captured.
Do you know who this informant was?
Yes. The traitor has been identified, though he does not realize he has been discovered. We decided to leave him feeling safe until he can be compromised. Then we can question him and try to find out where David and the others have been taken.
Let's hope it works.
When I show up in Hong Kong, our betrayer will see a chance to hand me over to the authorities. They would like very much to get their hands on me.
Anna, that's a hell of a risk.
Life is a risk. Every day is a risk. I have stayed away for too long. London has become an easy option. It's time I returned and picked up the pieces.
Now I can understand what David sees in you.
Flattery from a handsome man. Worth the trip just for that.
Two of Able team will go in with you. One way or the other, we have to locate David and his team.
My only worry is that Yo might have involved Sun Yang Ho. That man has a bad reputation. If David and the others are near Ho, they could really be in harm's way. Ho is totally indoctrinated into the North Korean ideology. He has no regard at all for Westerners. He considers them to be below him, less than nothing. Ho is a perfect creation of the revolution.
Then the sooner we get you back on home ground, the better. Are you sure you're up to this?
I am much better, almost back to normal. All that rest and care you arranged has paid off. I know David still believes I am too weak to do anything but look nice and let him pamper me. I'd be lying if I said I hadn't enjoyed it. But it is time I moved back into the real world. For the past weeks, I've been working out each day, Hal. I'm stronger than I look.
I can believe that, Anna. Now, tell me what you need.
Hong Kong. Hard rain swept in across the harbor, the junks and smaller boats rising and falling on the heavy swells. Mayanna turned away from the hotel window and paced across the room, impatience showing on her face. She checked her watch again.
Anna, sit down. I'm wearing out just watching you.
She glared at Blancanales, the tension between them almost visible. In the next breath, she relaxed and went back to sit in the chair she had been using earlier.
Sorry. I shouldn't take my feelings out on you. It's just...
You just want to get out on the job. Nothing wrong there.
That, and the fact I'm still getting back into the business.
You don't get out of this business. You can take a break, but it's still going to pull you back.
Consider me pulled. The car will be outside the hotel in 5 minutes. I would prefer we go down now.